Good morning. Okay, one more time. Good morning. I feel like a teacher now, as always. Most of you know me. My name is Sandy Carlson. I'm the membership coordinator here. But today I'm here in my guise as one of our special events people. Many of you have already heard about our Inside Happiness event that's coming up May 31st. But, okay, wait, I got to breathe. I know, typical. The Inside Happiness Project is a series of events, workshops, speakers, lots of different things that are going to help us explore how we find our own happiness. All right, you've seen some of the flyers going up. We'd like to have some more help. So see me afterwards if you want to help put up flyers or be involved with the project. But we're going to have a special speaker on May 31st. The event's going to be over at the UUFR so that we've got a little bit more room. Because we're expecting a good turnout. And our speaker is going to be Sherry Dillard, who's actually a mystic, a psychic detective. So I have visions of the Medium TV show. I don't know why. But I haven't personally had a chance to meet her, but I have heard about her. I've read some of her excerpts from her books. Fascinating. So we're going to be having this event again Friday, May 31st. Tickets are $12. It's going to be 2 hours, and there'll be times for questions and discussion with her as well. This is going to be an ongoing series. If you've seen the pictures when you came in out there, we've got some beautiful stunning pictures. Those two are Jim Barnes is one, and Andre. Those are two of the special people that were part of this project. We have pictures, beautiful stunning photographs, and their stories. These are people that have overcome very difficult situations to find happiness. And so I think that's something that we're all kind of looking for. So, again, there'll be more information at the table. If you're interested in purchasing a ticket, we can take care of that, too. If you're interested in helping with flyers or being a part of the project, see me. Thank you very much.
Hello, everyone. Happy Sunday. Geshe is not feeling well or manifesting illness, so he will not be teaching the two sessions today. Venerable Tricula will be teaching us. Geshe hasn't started yet, but he's going to start teaching The Art of Happiness, which is written by His Holiness and Howard Cutler, a medical doctor. And so when Tricula comes in, we'll probably stand and she'll probably invite us to prostrate with her. And she may say something afterwards. The table right here, things are arranged a little bit differently. And this was from leftover from our Tara practice. These are offerings to Mother Tara and the 21 emanations of Tara. And so that's what that is. If you have cell phones, if you would please either turn them off or put them on mute. And I think I haven't done that yet. Nope, I sure haven't. So I will do that right now. Okay. Okay, we will be saying, if you're new to the center, we'll be saying prayers in this white prayer book. There's only one book, so it's very easy. And if you're sitting in a chair, if you'll please get the copy behind you, and there are copies at the end of the pew if you have, if you're sitting in a pew. And we'll be saying prayers from the first bay sheet and at the bottom of the first pink sheet of this book. So let's just settle our minds and get ready to receive the teachings. Lama Zopa Rinpoche recommends when we are taking the teachings, whoever the teacher is, think, I am receiving this teaching from Guru Shakyamuni Buddha, Tara, Manjushri, Guhya Samaja, Yamantaka, Heruka, and all the numberless Buddhas. I am taking these teachings from all of them. Then think, each word I listen to frees me from the oceans of samsaric suffering by leaving an imprint on my mind and causing realization. Even more than that, each word frees me from the oceans of each realm suffering and brings me to full enlightenment. And that means I can free every single sentient being, every single hell being, hungry ghost, animal, human being, sura and asura, from the oceans of samsaric suffering and bring them to full enlightenment. Therefore, each word I listen to is so precious and wish fulfilling. Each of these words is so precious for me. Okay, so let's start by chanting Shakyamuni Buddha's mantra three times on the first base sheet where it says Kadampa Center Prayers, then the Four Immeasurables in English, and then right below in Tibetan. Taya ta om mune mune maha munaye so Tayata Om Mune Mune Maha Munaye Soha Tayata Om Mune Mune Maha Munaye Soha. May all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all sentient beings be inseparable from the happiness that is free from suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. Sentientam che deva dam deva yudam dempar juchi duchi 명령이 유던 죄와 주치 눈야매 배대와 땀이 되와 주치 예린 차담 니던 죄외 탄염 라네 파주치. Then turn the page to the first pink sheet and let's chant Chenrezig mantra. 8 times. Om Mani Padme Hum. 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 Then Green Tower's mantra right above. 7 times. Om Taritu Taritu Re Soha. 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 Om Taritu Taritu Re Soha.
Good morning. It's great to see everybody here this morning. So before we get started, let's just take a moment and rejoice about what a lovely opportunity it is that we're all here together, and how great that someone got the idea to start the center, and then Lama Zopa Rinpoche approved it, and then asked Geshe-la to come, and we've had Geshe-la here for these 15 years, and just really quite an amazingly rare thing if you think about it. So how wonderful that we're all here taking advantage. Yeah, so I was thinking, you know, this early morning session, or not early, but the first session, maybe it'd be nice if we did the laughing yoga first to just get us going. Some of you might know it. It's not traditionally a Tibetan practice, but Geshe-la is quite fond of it. So if we all just stand up for a second. I apologize, but I can't do it with a headset, so I'm just going to try to speak loudly. So the idea of this is just to sort of get our juices flowing and make us smile. So first thing you do is you sort of shake out your arm, and then we'll take a breath in, and with each exhale we'll shake our arms, and on the third exhale, instead of exhaling, just laugh as hard as you can, and don't be shy because we'll all be doing it so nobody will notice what you're doing. So first one. Second one. Excellent. Well done. All right. Well played. So now I'd like to take just a few minutes and review a couple of the meditations that Geshe-la has been teaching us. First, we'll start with a 9-round breathing meditation. And the reason we do this one is, you know, as we go through our day and we're not focused, we get this imbalanced energy that kind of gets stuck in our channels, the way that the energy moves through our body. And so by doing this, it helps eliminate that imbalanced energy. So it's really nice if you're doing this on a regular basis, because then you kind of know you're cleaning out the pipes a little bit. So just a quick refresher. Most people probably know how this one goes. You start using your left hand and you block your left nostril and you inhale through the right, and you do that slowly. And then you switch to the other side, and you exhale through the left. And you do that 3 times, and then you switch hands and do the same thing in the opposite direction. So you close the right nostril, inhale through the left, switch and exhale through the right, and do that 3 times. Then you do both together, inhaling and exhaling 3 times. It makes a total of 9. So if that was too quick and anybody's lost, feel free to come ask me afterwards, and we can do it more slowly. But I know a lot of people have heard this many times. So, all right, so let's just follow along together. So start with the inhale. Excellent. Well done. So now we'll do the 21 round breathing. And the purpose of this is to help us get better at concentration. It's through concentration that we really can calm our minds. And so this is sort of the weightlifting, doing the reps to strengthen up that ability to concentrate. So this one, we start with the exhale, and then we inhale, and we count that as 1. And then exhale, inhale, count that as 2. And go as long as you can concentrate and keep the count. If you lose count and you're like 6, 7, I'm not sure, just start back at 1 again. And that's part of the strengthening. So if you're not sure if it's 6 or 7 and you keep going, you're actually not getting as much benefit from it because you're not paying quite as much attention. So it's called 21 because you sort of set that as your first goal. But we'll just do this for a few minutes, so you may or may not reach that, and that's okay. When we're doing this meditation, it really helps if your back is straight. And you can put your hands in your lap or on your knees or whatever's comfortable. If you're in a chair, you might want to have your feet flat on the floor. If you're sitting on a cushion, you can just sit cross-legged. And we'll just do this for a few minutes. So just start with the exhale, inhale, count 1, and see how it goes. Welcome back. Yeah, so one of the things that's really nice about the meditation we just did is Geshe-la describes it as it can kind of put our mind in neutral. You know, if you've got any negative things going on, it's pretty hard to switch straight to a positive mind. But if you put it in a neutral space first, it's much easier to get into a happy mind. So that's one of the ways you can use this meditation to help get to that neutral space so then you can go somewhere positive from there. So, okay, so for the rest of our time today, I was thinking that we could talk about the book I heard Lama La mention, The Art of Happiness. Geshe-la has been talking about this book for some time, although I'm not sure we've read much from it. So today we will a little bit. And this book has really special personal meaning for me. It was one of the first Buddhist books that I read that really galvanized some of my conviction and thinking there's really something to this path that's working for me. So I'm really fond of this book and glad that we're spending some time with it. So first I'd like to start with a quote from the book where His Holiness says, "I believe that it is essential to appreciate our potential as human beings and recognize the importance of inner transformation." So let me just say that one more time. "I believe that it is essential to appreciate our potential as human beings and recognize the importance of inner transformation." So I just love the idea of thinking about, you know, change and how we do that and what that means. And so I thought we could try something that, so Venerable Thupten Chodron's going to be here next week as one of our visiting teachers. And I've had a really fortunate opportunity to be in retreat with her in the past. And one of the techniques that I've seen her use is where she'll ask a question and then we just sit in meditation on it for a short time, literally just 2 or 3 minutes. So we have a chance to really think about that question before we discuss it. So that can sometimes be a useful technique for people who aren't just quick to speak. And even if you don't speak, it might be helpful to have spent the time thinking. So I've got a few questions to ask, and then we'll have a little discussion on it. And then obviously at some point we're going to watch a short little video, but that's how I think things will go. We'll see if reality matches the plan. But so the first question I'd like us to think about is, can we really change? What does that really mean, and how does that feel? So maybe just let's shut our eyes, and I'll add in, after literally about just 60 to 90 seconds, I'll ask another question, and we'll think on that, and another question just for a few minutes. We'll do that. Then I'll ring the bell, and we'll come back for a discussion. So first think about, can we really change? And what about something in our mind, you know, like how we see a coworker, or something that's about changing the way we think? What about a habit or a behavior, you know, something of our body like smoking? And what do you think about speech? Changing something like choosing to say fewer critical things to our partner or our child? And then the last one, where are we more likely to get stuck? What are the harder types of change? Yeah, how was that? Did anybody have anything that came up that they'd like to share? Either, you know, is it possible to change? Where is it hard? Where is it easy? Anything that was kind of a surprise as you were thinking about it and it came up for you?
Sorry, I'll repeat. The way that you see yourself is the hardest thing to change, I think. When you're talking about, like, can you change, you know, habits and the way you treat people, but yourself is, I think, the hardest.
So self-perception is the most difficult.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that's a really interesting idea, how we form some idea about ourselves, and then that we somehow concretize that, think it's something really solid. Yeah, that's a really good point.
I was going to say, in general, to the question, can we change?
Mm-hmm.
The short answer would be if we want to.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. Excellent. You had something. Yeah.
I was thinking that, yes, you can change, but it takes determined mindfulness to catch yourself, you know, when you're not being virtuous, and that you just, you can do it, but you really have to watch. And then when you do make a mistake, admit it and, try to resolve that.
So maybe some vigilance mixed with some discipline. Is that fair to say? Yeah.
When you're maybe going to have a situation, doing that 1 minute,
you know, doing the stop,
mm-hmm.
and kind of get yourself together before proceeding.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's possible, but there's some work involved.
Yeah,
very much.
Yeah.
I think all we do is change, and it's an illusion to think that we don't change, and it's actually a lot of energy we put into concretizing ourselves, because I looked in the mirror this morning, all I do every second is change. And it's the energy to reinforce the ideas that I had yesterday and the day before and the day before.
Yeah, so that's a very Buddhist point of view. Yeah, that it's all change. I love there's a great quote, which I'll paraphrase, sorry, from Pema Chodron in one of her books, and she was talking with her teacher, and she said, you know, I'm fine most of the time, it's just during times of transition that I have trouble. And her teacher just laughed and said, it's all transition, you know. So, yeah, excellent point, Jill.
I was just going to say, as far as changing your way of thinking, sometimes you don't know you've changed until you are presented with that situation again.
Yes.
And then you notice that you actually changed.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And it can go both for the positive and the negative, right? We might think, here's a great example for me personally. I really think I'm getting better at my anger, you know, but it's maybe just I haven't had so many objects present themselves and challenge me, right? And then when the object presents itself and I get angry, I go, oh, yeah, still some work to do. Yeah. So, yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, so probably need to move on in the interest of our time, but thanks for sharing, and we'll have some more chances as we progress here. I also want to talk about one really interesting example of change that I saw about a year ago. There was a news article that came out about a skinhead who'd been very active in the cause, and then he made some changes and started a family and really wanted to change his life, but he was very heavily tattooed on his face, on his hands. He had the word hate on his hands. He had so many things on his face that he knew he was still this sort of walking billboard for something he no longer represented. And his wife described how he was to the point where he was researching online what kind of acid he could dump on his face to at least scar it to cover up the tattoos. And, you know, it was just on and on about how he'd made these choices. He recognized he'd made the choices to put him in this situation, but he wasn't sure how to get out, and they didn't have the money for the removal. So to sort of cut to the chase, eventually they found their way to the Southern Poverty Law Center, and they talked there, and the quotes from the attorney that they talked with there said, you know, at first I wasn't sure if this guy was real or not. We get a lot of folks who maybe in a time of crisis want to leave the movement, but then they come back. He said, but after spending weeks talking with this family, he realized that it was a true transformation this man was trying to make. And so in a very rare situation, the Southern Poverty Law Center doesn't usually do this. They found a personal donor for this man to have the surgeries. It turned out to be 25 surgeries over 16 months, cost $35,000, and they did a documentary of this process of how his face would balloon up after each one. He'd just have these oozing sores for days. I mean, it was just this terrible, painful process. But he was so grateful all along, just saying, this is allowing me to have a life again. And, you know, he saw it very much as penance for the mistakes he'd made. And so, anyway, I just love the story of, I mean, it's such a literally graphic transformation, because you see the pictures of what he looked like before and the pictures after he finished this process. So, anyway, if anybody wants more information to see this documentary or anything, let me know. I can give you links and things. But I love a redemptive tale. So, anyway. Okay, I'd like to read just a little bit, actually, from the book. This is, I don't know if anybody has a book, but it's on page 13. It's in chapter 1. This is His Holiness speaking, saying, I believe the very purpose of our life is to seek happiness. That is clear. Whether one believes in this religion or that religion, we are all seeking something better in life. So I think the very motion of our life is toward happiness. And then on the next page, his co-author asks His Holiness if he really believes happiness is a reasonable goal. Is it really possible for most people to achieve? And His Holiness replies, yes, I believe that happiness can be achieved through training the mind. So then His Holiness goes on to say a little bit more about what training the mind really means. And he says, when I say training the mind in this context, I'm not referring to mind merely as one's cognitive ability or intellect. Rather, I'm using the term in the sense of the Tibetan word sem, which has a much broader meaning, closer to psyche or spirit. It includes intellect and feeling, heart and mind. So by bringing about a certain inner discipline, we can undergo a transformation of our attitude, our entire outlook and approach to living. So that's similar to what you're saying. When we speak of this inner discipline, it can, of course, involve many things, many methods. But generally speaking, one begins by identifying those factors which lead to happiness and those factors which lead to suffering. Having done this, one then sets about gradually eliminating those factors that lead to suffering and cultivating those that lead to happiness. That is the way. And I love this quote because it's really clear. Seems pretty simple, right? Probably not so easy, right? But at least it's very simple. It's not, you know, a high-minded concept. We figure out what's going to lead us to happiness and try to do more of that, and what's going to lead us to suffering, do less of that, right? Pretty straightforward. So it made me think of that that old jazz song, Accentuate the Positive and Eliminate the Negative. I don't know how many of y'all know that one, but... all right, so let's just do our silent contemplation thing again on one more question, and we'll just do this for a short time and then talk about it. So can you think of an example where you've actually applied this in your life, where you found a behavior or a mindset and consciously tried to shift it? So anything come up that anybody wants to share? An example of something? Yeah, Marianne.
There's a girl that I work with that's been kind of challenging over the past 5 years, and I always thought she was just moody, and you know, you always look to yourself to say, well, God, what did I do to her? And then I came to thinking of, well, it's not always about me.
Yeah.
And maybe she's having a rough time. And maybe things are going wrong in her life that make it difficult for her to be at work or to be pleasant or whatever. And so changing the way I looked at things mm-hmm. made it easier for me to be around her and be more compassionate towards her.
Yeah, that's a great example, because the exterior didn't change at all. But by changing how you are looking at it, you're able to relate differently. Yeah. Yeah, that's a good one. Anybody else? Okay. So really, I mean, I see most of Buddhist practice as falling in this category, right? We're always trying to train our mind, work with our mind, transform our problems. You know, when we come to DB, when we come to Sunday morning, so much of it's really about this idea. So I was thinking maybe His Holiness could give us a few tips. So this is just a short clip when His Holiness was in Austria in May, so just about a year ago, and he was giving a talk called The Art of Happiness. And here's a short clip of him. But there's no sound. Turn up the, can you turn up the volume to... Hi.
On the computer, it turns up.
It'll be worth it. Yeah.
While we're waiting,
yeah.
I just wanted to add, if anybody wants to check out a nice little YouTube video,
mm-hmm.
There's a neuroscientist, neuroresearcher, Tony McGonigal, and Epiphio puts out the video, and it's How to Change Just About Anything. And it highlights her book, it's called The Willpower Instinct, and she highlights three different parts of the brain. There's the I won't power, which we think of as our willpower in resisting habitual behaviors. And then there's the I will power, and then the I want power. And she talks about cues, cues that that basically bring us towards the habitual behavior. So you have to watch out for the cues and be mindful of the cues in order to change the behavior. Because then that's once you have the habitual behavior, then there's something in the brain that's satisfied, and opioids and different things like that happen in the brain. And then we feel kind of instant gratification for a brief moment. And so you have to really be mindful of the cues, and that's how you can be more mindful in the process and not do the visual behavior. And then also focusing on the I want power, which is the long-term result that you want by not doing the negative habitual behavior.
And all that actually we're going to talk about in just a little bit, so that's spot on. Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Willpower instinct.
What's going on over there, Chris? So, if we can't figure it out in about another 30 seconds, I'll just tell you what His Holiness said. It would be much better coming from Him, but I don't want us to spend a lot of time waiting on this. The settings we had before worked fine, so I'm not sure what you're changing around there, Chris. I can't see. So I won't do it as elegantly, but the gist of what His Holiness is talking about is that that our real disturbing emotions are they're not sensorial. They're not, you know, coming from what we're perceiving externally. They're coming at the mental level. And so, like we talk about quite often, that calm mind is what's essential to achieving the happiness. And if we pay more attention to what's happening in that inner world, it will really help us then be able to better find ways to be happiness, to control the mental aspect. And he talked about how, you know, we spend so much time on the external world, you know, trying to learn about what's out there, you know. And then he actually takes his little visor off and he says, but here in our skull, you know, that's where we need to spend more time. And so he says it's useful to think about the mind and the emotions and all of that. And one way that we can do that is try to use sort of another part of ourselves to watch ourselves when we're angry. And so anger is probably the easiest disturbing emotion to talk about in this way, right? I mean, we have plenty, or we could talk about when we're jealous or when we're prideful, but anger can be so strong that it can be a really useful learning tool. So if we can get outside of ourselves while we're going through one of those rants and sort of watch what's happening, that can do a couple of things. It can help us learn about the anger, and then it can also help us decrease the anger right there in the moment. So he says, you know, as you watch it, the anger will, you'll actually watch the anger reducing. So the whole point is to look inward about our mind. So when we talk about this mental level, you know, not the external but the mental, what do you think is meant by that? I mean, can you all, does that make sense to folks? Do you all grasp what we're talking about there? Yes, no? Yeah, Kim.
So what I think about when we talk about external and internal, it can be in a situation where there might be a noise that's bothering me. That's all I can hear. What is that noise? Why is that happening? And then other times, same noise, same situation, doesn't bother me at all.
Mm-hmm.
So that the external hasn't changed a bit, but inside I've changed. So I think maybe that mental level is something there.
Yeah, yeah, that's a good example, and kind of tying in with what Marianne was saying about her coworker. Yeah. Anybody else? Okay. And then when His Holiness is talking about exploring the inner world, so there's one thing to sort of notice it when it's happening, like that noise is bugging me, right? And is it the noise or is it me? You know, you can kind of do that. What would it mean to explore your inner world in a proactive way? Anybody have an idea what I mean by that? Yeah, sure, that's one way, for sure. So sort of really trying to notice what's there at different times and different situations. Take the inventory. Yeah, yeah. And so this practical idea that His Holiness talks about really watching our mind from this other part of our mind, has anybody ever done that? Do people know what that feels like? Yeah. Anybody have any kind of experience with that, either positive or negative, that they'd want to share? I know for me sometimes when I do that, I'm actually pleasantly surprised, and other times I'm kind of shocked, you know, because, oh, wow, yeah, I'm doing that, you know. So it can, if we're being sort of honest in the inventory, we can see some really positive things, and then we can also see some things that maybe we wish we'd do differently. I had a situation happen recently where I... where I became really angry about something that hadn't happened in a long time, that I'd become really angry. Make it stop! Make it stop! And so in watching that, it was really interesting to see things again, that what I talked about earlier, about where we think maybe we've gotten better at something. And it was just this particular object, when it presented itself, really got me going. And it was a little disturbing to watch, you know? Like, wow, I wish I'd had a video of it so I could really have a little more objective experience of it, you know? Like, what did I really say? How did that really go? Because, of course, I had my version of it in my head, but I have no idea if it is anywhere near what someone else would have seen in the same situation. So, yeah, Tracy.
I don't know if this is exactly what you're talking about, but I feel like for me, sometimes studying this stuff makes me realize just how much of a negative mind I have had in the past.
Mm.
And a good example is a lot of the quote-unquote accomplishments in my life came from me and my negative mind state saying, I'm going to fail, so I must work harder, I must do this, I must do better. And even just, you know, obviously with school, but even just cleaning my house, it's like, oh, you know, I can't stand this, I've got to get it. Just that negative energy is what motivated me. So I find that it's a really big change, almost like 180 degrees, to sort of be motivated more by the joyful effort and more of those positive thoughts. So I don't know if that fits, but I just wanted to share it.
Sure, that's great. Yeah. Yeah, so how we're approaching it can really make a big difference, even if it looks exactly the same to someone on the outside, right? You're still cleaning your house, but whether you're doing it with joyful effort or because of some notion of shoulds or, you know, I hate it being messy. Yeah, that's a really good point. Yeah. Okay, so that's a really good segue, actually, into our final point. I wanted to talk a little bit about contentment, because Geshe-la has been talking about this topic for the past few weeks, about what's happiness, what's contentment, what does all that mean, you know. And so I thought it might be interesting if I read again a little bit from the book on contentment. So this is in chapter 2, starts on page 27. And this is His Holiness saying, I think there are two kinds of desire. Certain desires are positive, a desire for happiness. It's absolutely right. The desire for peace, the desire for a more harmonious world, a friendlier world. Certain desires are very useful. But at the same point, desires can be unreasonable. That usually leads to trouble. Now, for example, sometimes I visit supermarkets. I really love to see supermarkets because I can see so many beautiful things. So when I look at all these different articles, I develop a feeling of desire, and my initial impulse might be, oh, I want this, I want that. Then the second thought that arises, I ask myself, oh, do I really need this? And the answer is usually no. If you follow after that first desire, that initial impulse, then very soon your pockets will be empty. However, the other levels of desire, based on one's essential needs of food, clothing, and shelter, is something more reasonable. Sometimes whether a desire is excessive or negative depends on the circumstances or society in which you live. For example, if you live in a prosperous society where a car is required to help you manage in your daily life, then of course there's nothing wrong in desiring a car. But if you live in a poor village in India where you can manage quite well without a car, but you still desire one, even if you have the money to buy it, it can ultimately bring trouble. It can create an uncomfortable feeling among your neighbors and so on. Or if you're living in a more prosperous society and have a car, but keep wanting more expensive cars, that leads to the same kind of problems. So then the author comes back and says, but I can't see how wanting to buy a more expensive car leads to problems for an individual as long as he or she can afford it. Having a more expensive car than your neighbors might be a problem for them. They might be jealous and so on. But having a new car would give you yourself a feeling of satisfaction and enjoyment. And then the Dalai Lama shook his head and replied, no, self-satisfaction alone can't determine if a desire or action is positive or negative. A murderer may have a feeling of satisfaction at the time he's committing the murder, but that doesn't justify the act. All of the non-virtuous actions, lying, stealing, sexual misconduct, and so on, are committed by people who may be feeling a sense of satisfaction at the time. The demarcation between a positive and negative desire or action is not whether it gives you an immediate feeling of satisfaction, but whether it ultimately results in positive or negative consequences. Whether it ultimately results in positive or negative consequences. For example, in the case of wanting more expensive possessions, if that's based on a mental attitude that just wants more and more, then eventually you'll reach a limit of what you can get. You'll come up against reality. And when you reach that limit, then you'll lose all hope, sink down into depression, and so on. That's one danger inherent in that type of desire. So I think that this kind of excessive desire leads to greed, an exaggerated form of desire based on over-expectation. And when you reflect upon the excess of greed, you'll find that it leads an individual to a feeling of frustration, disappointment, a lot of confusion, and a lot of problems. When it comes to dealing with greed, one thing that is quite characteristic is that although it arrives by the desire to obtain something, it is not satisfied by obtaining. Therefore, it becomes sort of limitless, sort of bottomless, and that leads to trouble. One interesting thing about greed is that although the underlying motive is to seek satisfaction, the irony is that even after obtaining the object of your desire, you're still not satisfied. The true antidote of greed is contentment. If you have a strong sense of contentment, it doesn't matter whether you obtain the object or not. Either way, you're still content. So let's unpack this a little bit and talk about a few of these pieces. So kind of in line of the book and the willpower and the won't power that you were talking about, that idea of the initial impulse, right? We first have this thing that I'm in the grocery store and I want that, right? We all know what that feels like. That comes up. That's easy to think of a time that that's happened. And then that second piece, you know, the sort of what should we do about it? His Holiness says, you know, well, we can try to figure out do we really need it or not. And sometimes the answer is yes, you know, but a lot of times we want something and the answer is no, I don't really need it. So, can anybody think of why these problems come up, you know? I mean, His Holiness used that word problem and trouble several times in that passage. Why would it matter? Like, you know, like the co-author said, well, but if you can do it, what's the problem? Yeah, Marianne.
I think a lot of it stems from striving, you know, that we always want to keep up with the Joneses, and it ties in what we have, our possessions, what we're able to buy, is tied into our self-worth and our self-evaluation. You know, I am able to afford a Jaguar, a McMansion, a boat, a whatever. It's like the old thing of you buy this great new car and then, oh, you're so worried because what happens if it gets scratched and what if somebody dings it or somebody hits me, and you're more worried about the car than are you really that happy with it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it has a lot to do with how we see ourselves and our value and our worth within society. Whereas if we can say, this is me, there's a difference between what I want and what I truly need, there's a big difference between that. Whether we're in the grocery store and yeah, I can buy the name brand or I can buy the same thing that'll do the same thing for me in the store brand.
Yeah. So from the point of view of
what it looks like before you get it. So there's the, it looks pretty good before you get it, right, the Jaguar or whatever. But then once you get it, the reality of what it's like to own it is maybe not what the expectation of it was, right? Yeah, and so then you spend all this time worrying about it, and it's not, you're not enjoying it. Yeah, it's not fun. Yeah.
In addition to what she was saying, I think that, or I wonder if for most people, we place more value on what society thinks of us versus ourselves. I know the store brand is just as good, but what if my friend comes over and sees that I'm feeding my family store brand food? You know, I mean, like, we place so much value on what other people are going to judge us on.
Mm. Yeah, so it makes it a little harder maybe to just sort of figure it out for yourself and do what makes sense when you add that extra layer of the judgment.
Or even if you know, intuitively you know, or intellectually you know, but you still make the effort to keep up with the Joneses.
Yeah.
I was just thinking when you, with things like that, you're forming an attachment that's ultimately going to fail.
Mm-hmm.
It's make you happy for 5 minutes and that's it.
Yeah, that's a really excellent point, because what's the definition of attachment? It's exaggerating the positive qualities of something, right? And that's what we're doing as the, oh, I want it, right? That's, we're exaggerating what's positive. Because otherwise, when we got it, we'd feel all those things we thought we were going to feel, right? Yeah.
And the other things that I think about wanting it more and getting a better car, even though I can afford it, is if I really need that better car, more expensive car, when there are other people in the other part of the world that are needing the, just the very minimum things, and then I'm just worried about, should I get this house or should I get this house? And I think for rest of us that we have this luxury of having a good life, that's our responsibility to think about other people in the different part of the world, even in our neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
Might be somebody that needs something. So should I spend that money and give that money to that person or get a better car for myself? I guess that's when give us the responsibility to be responsible for all of human being, not just ourselves and my family.
Yeah, so the choices that we're making affect more than just ourselves. Yeah, and so even if it were as luscious and as great as we think it's going to be, which it never is, even then there's the question of, is that still the right choice? Yeah. Yeah. I saw one more hand back here. Yeah. And then we're going to move on to the next one. Yeah.
Yeah, I was just going to say, jumping off of that concept of, to me, that I think of that because to me that just solidifies how what success is just a state of mind, where you're living in a place where that's not even an option on the table, that society doesn't even go there mentally and think this is what success is, because it doesn't even exist for them. And yet in our country it exists for us, because it's just a state of, it's just the way, it's ideas that we have all built around what success is. And if it's, you're living in a country where that's not an option on the table, it doesn't even factor in, are you successful if you have this thing or you don't, because it doesn't exist within the society as an option. So to me, that further solidifies that it's just a state of mind. It's just a belief system we've created.
Yeah, so I think that really gets at this idea of the grasping, because no matter what level you're at, if you're grasping for the next level, and that can be very different depending on where you're starting from, but it's still that same idea of, yeah, the more, yeah. Okay, and so in that passage, why does His Holiness say that feeling satisfied by an action is not the correct measure of whether it's positive or negative? You know, it's not just about how we feel about it, either while we're doing it or after. Do y'all remember? Yeah, so sort of how it plays out in the long term. What are the consequences over time, right? And so, again, you can sort of peel that back. There's all kinds of layers of what that means, too, you know. It's sort of like, do you like it or not? Did it make you happy or not? Was it good for a greater society. You know, if you have any notion of karma, how does it affect your karma? How will that affect things in the bigger picture for you and for other people? So it can kind of keep expanding out and out and out. Yeah, so there's lots of ways to evaluate it. And I thought that was such a skillful example that, you know, even a murderer may feel satisfaction at the time of murder, you know. But I think most of us wouldn't think that that was, you know, that his level of satisfaction was the right way to judge the act. Yeah. Okay. So I love this quote, the true antidote of greed is contentment. If you have a strong sense of contentment, it doesn't matter whether you obtain the object or not. Either way, you're still content. So what do you think about that? I mean, I think that's sort of obvious on the surface, but then when I tried to think of examples, it becomes more complicated, you know? You want me to read the quote again? Okay. The true antidote of greed is contentment. If you have a strong sense of contentment, it doesn't matter whether you obtain the object or not. Either way, you're still content. So, I mean, I think on the one level, it gets at what several of you have already said, where it's sort of like, if you've changed how your mind is about something, then the external is less important, right? I think that's kind of part of it. But just really trying to think about creating this universal contentment when you really want, you know, that hot fudge sundae or whatever it is. Again, it's one of those things that's simple, but maybe not so easy to do in each time it comes up. I don't know. Does anybody have an example where they were successful with that? Yeah.
I found that I'll keep a list, either a mental list or a little written list. If I want something, I'll put it on the list. I find that now I hardly ever put anything on my list. But then I'll look at my list a week later, a month later. Mm-hmm. I cross things off the list. I don't want them anymore. So it proves, and I get satisfaction out of wanting the thing and not in ever even getting it.
Yeah.
And so it proves to me how meaningless attaining something is. And then if you start to put it into larger and larger wants, like what if I won the lottery or, you know, something really huge. You can start to put it in perspective. Am I content without winning the lottery? Would I walk away from winning the lottery? You can start to realize how little you really do want and how little satisfaction actually getting something provides you.
Yeah. I think that's a fantastic tool, you know, the list and sort of watching it over time. It's sort of the opposite of Amazon one click or, you know, all these things that encourage us to, you got the impulse, get it right now and it's no effort, right? Yeah. And so this puts a little bit of a space in between that first impulse and the actual acquisition. And then you realize that maybe you don't even want it after time. Yeah. I love that example.
Along the lines of that same example, I'll take my daughter shopping and at first she'll want this or want that, and I'll say, well, then put it on hold, and you can always come back and get it. And at the end of the day, we usually don't go back and get anything. Or maybe something that she really, really is like, no, I really do still want that.
Yeah.
But a lot of times it's like, oh, I don't want that. And I think having gratitude for things goes a long way for contentment.
Yeah. So both of those are really excellent points. Again, that putting that buffer between the wanting and the decision to get it or not can be really helpful. Just the time and space buffer. Yeah. And then the idea of gratitude. I love the idea of thinking of that as part of contentment, because if you're grateful for what you have, it's a lot easier to not want so much more. Right? Yeah.
Or then asking yourself why. Why is it that you want the impulse and then addressing that issue instead.
Yeah.
Figuring out what is actually you really need.
Yeah.
That's what you want.
Yeah. So the why can really help you peel back, you know, is this a necessity or not? Yeah. Yeah. Good point. Yeah. And so we've kind of talked some around it. Does anybody actually have a definition of contentment? I think this is maybe one of the harder questions of the day. Got it here at the end for you. I mean, I can read you the Webster's version, but yeah, I'd love to hear what people have to say.
Freedom from desire.
Yeah, sure. That's a great way to just sum it up. You know, you got enough. You're not striving for something else. Yeah. Anybody else? All right. Well, maybe we'll wrap up there then. So just to recap, the takeaways as I see them, you obviously will have your own. So we each can have our own redemptive tale, you know. This inner transformation is possible. And if we watch our own minds, it's one way to see the negative emotions and begin to work with them and get some distance from the story that they bring. And the correct measure of an action, according to His Holiness, is whether it results in positive or negative consequences. So trying to maybe think things through a few more steps. And cultivating contentment is the key to keeping our desires from turning into causes of further suffering. So thanks for being part of this discussion. Let's take just a second to rejoice if there's any positive merit that we created by thinking about this today. Let's try to carry that out into our day and into our week. And maybe if you're interested, make a commitment to yourself to watch your mind a little more keenly over the next couple of days and see if you can learn anything that helps you better be able to find happiness and then in turn be able to have that spread out to those around you because they've got contact with you as a happy you. So, one last quote from His Holiness. Y'all have probably heard this one before, but be kind whenever possible. It's always possible. So we can say some dedication prayers.
First pink sheet in the white prayer book. We'll start with the dedications at the top. but before we do, I'd like, I'm supposed to make this announcement. Okay, all right, so I'll read the prayer list. Prayers for a happy rebirth. All those killed by natural and man-made disasters, especially those at the Boston Marathon. All the Tibetans who have been killed or have taken their own lives in the struggle for religious freedom. Ruth Appleby, Ron Burroughs, Claire Caruso, father of Jessica Dijkstra, Bill Johnson, Claudia Kunt, Chelsea the cat, Dakota the dog, Kook the cat, Shanti the dog, Job Search, Daniel Dimitrov. Prayers for health and well-being. For the well-being of His Holiness, the Dalai Lama, Kyabje Lama Zopa Rinpoche, Master Gurme Ken Rinpoche, Jetson Losam Dalek, His Eminence Choden Rinpoche, Geshe Gyalek Choda, Geshe Palden Sangpo, Venerable Cherkila. All those harmed by natural and man-made disasters, especially those at the Boston Marathon. For the Tibetan people and for the Chinese authorities, may the nonviolent path lead to full reconciliation and religious freedom. Jim Barnes, Lorelei Barnes, Roseanne Barona, Becky, Ron Burroughs' family, Victoria Easterday Clark, June Elliott, Guillermo Garcia and family, Gary Goldberg, Mildred Gooch, Scott Griffin and family, Ken and Annie Hassel, Leslie and Joan Inman, Kenny Jackson Buddy, Bill Johnson's family, Helen Kasanoff, Meredith Kilmer, Shanti and Kurt Latimer, Vanessa Lillig and family, Gary Marshall, Aaron Mervin and his family, Shelley Miller, Rishka Mitra and family, Adrian Oliver, Jameen Pandya, Jay Pandya, Jeff Peterson and family, Aunt Polly, Chuck and Faye Renard, Scooby Rodriguez, Dr. Albert Sants, Rosemary Cease, Dion Washington, Suzanne Williams, Kathy Wormser, Judas Wormser, the Zeta Psi chapter of Pi Kappa Phi at Everett University, Ivy the dog, Loki the cat, Pierre the dog. If you have any names you'd like to add, would you please say them now? May all beings everywhere, plagued by sufferings of body and mind, obtain an ocean of happiness and joy by virtue of my merits. May no living creature suffer, commit evil, or ever fall ill. May no one be afraid or belittled with a mind weighed down by depression. May the blind see forms and the deaf hear sounds. May those whose bodies are worn with toil be restored on finding repose. May the naked find clothing, doth the hungry find food. May the thirsty find water and delicious drinks. May the poor find wealth, those weak with sorrow find joy. May the forlorn find hope, constant happiness, and prosperity. May there be timely rains and bountiful harvests. May all medicines be effective and wholesome prayers bear fruit. May all who are sick and ill quickly be freed from their ailments. Whatever diseases there are in the world, may they never occur again. May the frightened cease to be afraid and those bound be freed. May the powerless find power and may people think of benefiting each other. For as long as space remains, for as long as sentient beings remain, until then may I too remain to dispel the miseries of the world. In the land encircled by snow mountains, you are the source of all happiness and good, all-powerful Tenrezig Tenzin Gyatso. Please remain until samsara ends. Savior of the snowland teachings and transmigratory beings, who extensively clarifies the path that unifies emptiness and compassion, to the lotus in the hand, Lord Tenzin Gyatso, I beseech, may all your holy wishes be fulfilled. The one who mastered his speech at a very young age, the one with great patience who received the name Avatara, the one with great precision who spread the teachings of Lama Tsongkhapa on bliss and void, Lama ornament of the yellow hat tradition, please remain until samsara ends. You uphold the subduer's moral way, who serve as a bountiful bearer of all, sustaining, preserving, and spreading Manjana's victorious doctrine, who masterfully accomplished magnificent prayers honoring the three jewels, Savior of myself and others, your disciples, please, please, long, please, long. Now let's say seven Tara, green Tara mantras for Geshe's long, healthy, happy life. Om Tare Tu Tare Tu Re Soha. 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 Om Tare Tu Tare Tu Re Soha.